Hello, Deha. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
Hello, beloveds. Here's our first conversation with Jodie Clover. Jodie is one of my favorite people. I love how she sees the world. I think she has this deep compassion and empathy for everyone, and her ability to articulate the deep process that it is to be human is so inspirational and always ignites something within me. I feel heard by Jodie as a friend, and I feel heard by her as a counselor, and I think she has so much to offer the world, so I'm excited for you all to hear from her.
For all those who are listening to this Flourishing Practitioners podcast, Jodie is in my counselling supervision group, actually, is how we first met. She works currently as a counsellor for an NDIS service, and she is part of Clover Healing, the heart-centered healing practice. From the discussions I've had with you over the time, from my vibe of you and the energy of you, I feel like you have so much wisdom that sometimes isn't spoken about in our practice in a way. I'm so looking forward to sharing that energy with you today. Yes, thank you for being here first off. And secondly, I would just love to hear what drew you into counselling, what you comes forth for you to share in that way.
First of all, thank you for having me. It's very humbling to be invited into this space, and I really was blown away at the invitation of being invited to your space. So thank you so much. What drew me to counselling? I was at a crossroads in my life where I was separated in a new relationship, and I've got three boys who were transitioning into early adulthood. I had this burning feeling in my belly for about 2 years that there's something else I need to be doing. But at that time, my priority was raising my three boys, and I was working part-time as a corporate sales manager whilst also being on social services as well. And that was tough going financially, which created this sense of wanting to do something with my life. I think started to arise, like once my son was turning 16, I realised that pretty soon they're all going to be launching into the next phase of their life. And what am I going to do? Like I said, I sat with that feeling for 2 years. Was it a business? Was it getting a qualification in the field that I was working in? I realised that wasn't my thing, even though I knew I could do that with my eyes closed. It wasn't the fire in my belly. And one day I was watching an episode of Gypsy, which is probably not a great example of what a therapist is. But the first episode, I sat there and I was ironing and watching the show and thought, I can do that. In fact, I'll do that. I do that all the time. I could do that and get paid for it. And that's how it all started. And from the moment that I searched universities, enrolled, everything just flowed. Even getting there, the transport was easy. Everything was just easy. The work itself, that was intense because I really immersed myself in the work for 3 years. That's how I came to be here.
And you're, from what I perceive, you're such a natural. So I love that when we make those decisions in life, it is easy, even though there's challenges. It's sort of that clarity. I think that's a nice thing for people that are sometimes searching for their passion or they're wondering to know, is that our right decisions do flow, even if there's like mental blocks we sometimes have to navigate as well. I would love to hear how you view counselling now. This is something I'm exploring a bit as I'm stepping more into this space, is like I don't feel there's actually a definition for what we do in a way that people can understand readily. So I'd love to hear how you see it.
In its simplicity, is it's one person being in, one human being in contact with another human, and the space between that energetic field between the two human beings being in relation is a safe space for people to talk about things. And you probably heard it yourself many times. People will often say, I don't talk about this, or I don't know why I said that, because I don't normally talk about this, or it shows me that there is a lot of things that people bottle up or don't feel comfortable exposing in their everyday relationships, but there's just something that happens in between when they feel safe to do it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear as well on that safety. What do you feel that we do that creates safety?
Like you said in the introduction, I come from a heart space, and I think that sort of comes through a felt sense as well. Quite often I am told, oh, you're different from the others, or what's your degree again? Because I don't fit into the, especially for people who have been through the mental health system for many years, some even decades, coming into a counselling space is a little bit different for them, and trying to work it out because it's not as regimented. You know, I think a big part of the work is establishing that trust. The word empathy comes up too, being able to express empathy. I remember hearing a TED talk where the anatomy of empathy is to be seen, to be heard, and to be understood. And I think that's what a counselling space offers. I see you, I hear you, and I understand you. Beyond that, coming from a person-centred approach or a heart-centred approach is compassion. And that goes beyond empathy, because the one thing that I have noticed through the work that I do is when you become empathetic to a person's circumstances, you pretty quickly transfer into what it would be like for you, which is the whole definition of empathy, is to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, but then you're in your story and you get further away from theirs of what it would be like for you if you were having that experience. So compassion brings you back to that's happening to them, and that's, you know, I feel really sad that that's happening to them, or being able to reflect, I'm so sorry that happened to you because it's not happening to me. So it's sort of like a protective emotion as well as being able to connect with that person.
That understanding of person-centeredness is such a required skill set of us, but also we need to interrogate that. I feel like you did describe it really well. I loved how you connected heart-centered. How would you describe person-centered and heart-centered together?
For me, the whole reason why I'm here and doing this work is because of my love for humanity. And I think that's where the heart part comes in, that we're just all trying to do life the best we can. And to be able to share that with another person, our struggles, because to be human means we are going to experience anxiety, we are going to experience suffering and loss and grief and all those things that, and person-centered, interconnected with that is not judging. It's not wrong, it's not right, it's just, it's here, and invite that into the space to talk about it. I think when people suppress those things or try to push them down or ignore them, that's when stuff happens. So being able to bring that into the light so that it doesn't have that much power over them.
Would you have any thoughts on how, you know, for people who are new to this space, on how not to be judgmental if something is arising for them? Or is that just something you were naturally able to achieve, or is that something you've worked on?
I think it's a bit of toggling that happens, because reflective practice is a very big part of the work that I do, and unpacking my reactions to the things that are coming up in a space, or my thoughts on certain societal, you know, like I remember when I started uni, the first thing that we were asked in one of our classes was, who would you not work with? And through working in the space that I'm working at now, I've been exposed to all elements and presentations, and some of which were listed as people I didn't think I could work with. But then to my surprise, coming from a heart-centered space, I can work with those people.
It's so funny. I'm flicking into when I remember when we got asked that question, and then immediately that week I booked 4 clients that had that presentation of what I and I was like, oh my God, Gabrielle, like you're literally being tested immediately. I found that thought difficult for me. I really am person-centered. Like there's no thing like, oh, I won't work with anyone with that thing or that presentation. The thing I'm more not able to work with is like not wanting to change. For me, there has to be some desire to be in that, like the connection in the work I do. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it would be different if I was in a traditional counseling space. There has to be the choice to have stepped into my space. That needs to be present for me in opening my practice. But aside from that, because there's such beauty in unpacking that non-judgmentalness and for myself too, you know, like really being like, wow, like I can't, and the honor of being able to see some of the pieces of humanity that aren't discussed outside those sorts of our spaces, and just the gratitude is what I feel often.
And usually behind some of the behaviours, when you get into their backstory, there's a lot of trauma, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of suffering. There's, I think 85% of the people that I work with have experienced childhood sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, psychological abuse, and some have been quite horrific to hear. And then things start to make sense. Then in the space that we're in now, you're working with the here and now. So that's only relevant what has happened in the past insofar as how it's present in what's happening right now. Being able to sit in that space with people like that too, as a practitioner, comes from a lot of work on knowing who you are to feel confident to be able to hold that space.
Mm, yeah. Completely. For me, that's part of why these discussions are important, because I want people to be thinking about not just, oh, I learned this and this is how I hold space. It's like, who are you? How do you hold space? Like, what are the individual things? Like, how much can you meet in the presence and the heart? Mm-hmm. But what are your barriers in that connection to in capacity?
My barriers around my heart, after going through a messy breakup in my last relationship. And I say messy because it was messy for me. There was a lot of things that I had to unpack. And I remember listening to a spiritual healer by the name of Matt Kahn. And there was something that he said that really woke me up. When you have your heart smashed to smithereens, most people try to put it all back together again and sometimes build it even stronger. But his suggestion was to leave it smashed, because then it's open to everything. And that's how, that was a really transformative idea and thought experiment to run with, that I actually embody that now, that my heart is open to everything. So I don't sort of experience those boundaries or barriers.
That's my perception of you completely, is that would you, just drawing on that a little bit more, there's the societal pressure, there's the industry pressure, like put up these walls, create these boundaries. What would you say to someone who knows they have more heart work to do or more dropping of armor in the heart? What would you share with them?
First of all, I'd highly recommend anything that Brené Brown's written for reading material. Well, another thing that I learned in my journey of the messy breakup was how much I had immersed myself into others and not so much into myself. And so that whole notion of, oh, self-care, self-love, and it's kind of an abstract thing to say to somebody that hasn't maybe experienced what it means to feel loved. Or for me, a lot of the work was being the person that I needed for myself. And that meant I had to apply what I was giving to others and what I had learned from a person-centered approach to myself. And I think therein lies, that's the work of a counsellor, is to help their, I keep going to say participants because that's what we call them in the MDIS. Oh. the people that you're working with, is to help them learn and give them the skills to learn to like themselves again if loving seems too traumatic at that time, and eventually to love themselves too, but to give that approach, not to judge themselves, to have curiosity, develop skills and reflective practice, learn that there is a space between something happening and a reaction to it. There is time to respond instead of react. You know, let's calm the limbic system down and all those things that you learn.
There's this perception, oh, like counselling will heal you, like this is the answer, or even with self-care, like whatever the thing is, and it's not. It's a relationship and it's a learning process and an ongoing one. And you do have leaps and do learn more, but then you have to learn again. Like even recently I went through a whole other thing of like, oh, I've like got to learn what self-care I need at this point in my life, this time. It's different than what was nourishing before, because there's new things emerging.
Well, that's another thing that I learned from Matt Kahn too, is that every aha moment is just going to be something else you're going to wake up out of eventually as we ascend up, because we're always becoming. You know, I know we've spoken about Irvin Yalom a lot, but, you know, that's the title of his book, Becoming Myself. And he wrote that in his 80s or late 80s. So we're always becoming. It's fluid. It's always moving. It's not a destination. It's just happening all the time.
Maybe I'm speaking from my own perspective rather than being yours, but for me, I'm very like reflective in my practice, so that when I'm with a client, I'm totally there. But those things or those thinkings or that existentiality will be like informing my being in those moments. So do you have anything to say to that?
I think the most important thing is like what we've been talking about that space of being person-centered is what they call a phenomenological approach, which is just being in the moment. And that's one thing that I love about the space, is that whatever the person is bringing into the space is what you're working with at that time. So we may have just talked about something last time, but then they've come in with something completely new the next time. Being able to sit and feel comfortable with not knowing. The fact that Professor Sam Vaknin just said in a podcast recently, he could study the mind for 3 to 4 lifetimes and still know nothing. And I think that's a really humbling thing, that it's not for us to actually know what's going on for the person, but it's to help them tap into their own wisdom. And sometimes I find that my reflective practice is sometimes those sessions that we have together may feel like it was skirting on the surface. So my own sort of imposter syndrome rears up. Oh, I don't feel like I did anything. I don't think, you know, so there's a lot of reflective practice around that. I'm an avid CPD person. So I'm always listening to webinars or listening to my favorite psychologists on YouTube and spiritual advisors and meditation healers. I'm very eclectic. I really love Jungian philosophy. I love the existential philosophers, and then some of the practical advice, so that there is a lot to be able to sort of offer, but it's stuff that's aligned with me. That's one thing that I learned very quickly when I was at uni, was every modality that we were learning, when I had to write an assessment on the piece, I wrote an assessment as though I was the person receiving the treatment in my mind, like I embodied that. And if it felt like it induced
shame, can sometimes be very present in terms of internalized shame because of colonization, but then also intercultural shame because of different access to culture people had. And then also like some of the eldership ways that people were taught. For me, it's just so, 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 so important that shame is something I'm cleansing of my own way of being taught, but also in terms of how I transmit. It's so important to me, the most important. And I think sometimes we don't see where we have those little tendencies to activate shame, because that embodiment thing, I'm so somatic and I learn so much through my body. For my trainings, I'm just thinking as well. That's why I encourage them so much, like receive your own healing, like go and receive healing, not just to receive the healing, but to know in a space holding, is that for you? Feel if what you're doing to someone is you, how would that feel for you? And not to judge that person or their practice or how they do, but know in your body how it feels to be held, and let yourself be held and then integrate that also into your practice.
The stigma of having a mental health challenge and the way society talks about certain people that have mental health challenges, you know, all those things where everything interconnects and that intersectionality. But for me, I tend to just, I more zoom out and I see us all as doing the best we can to get through life. Life teaches us how to do life too. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We take a lot of things for granted too. The fact that we say, oh, I'll see you next week. Well, we say that without even knowing if that's actually going to be true. Looping back to knowing who you are is so important in terms of not taking on other people's offerings. You know, there's that Buddha saying, if somebody comes to you with the gift of their anger and you don't accept it, to whom does it belong? But that's not to say that you actually want to cause the person seeking help any more grief. But there was an interesting experience that I had where I worked with a man that in the first 6 to 8 sessions, there was a lot of anger, a lot of what I call puffing up and talking over with a big booming voice. And I know that the person that he worked with previously experienced that as, oh, it makes me nervous. And it was probably halfway through that I was able to, I knew that our relationship was, that trust was establishing. He was opening up a little bit more. He was softening around the edges. You could see that sort of transformation where that was becoming less and less and there was a more softening, where I was able to reflect to him that time in a way that, does he do this in his everyday life with other people as a protective factor? And to reflect back to him that when he was doing that to me, I never felt threatened. I never felt scared, because what I saw was he was showing me how small he felt when he was being abused as a child. So I think the lesson there is, sometimes when people are projecting things onto you, and you feel it, you have that visceral response to what you're hearing, they're giving you a clue of how they felt when they went through an experience.
That's a good reflection of that. Also, I often think of anger as like a melon. Like, it's got a hard exterior, but when you push it inside, there's a soft, yeah, like lovely juiciness. Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Like, but I've got to get through the spiky bits on the outside of the yummy fruit.
It's exactly like that, isn't it? It's quite nice to see the transformation and the shock on his face when I reflected that back to him, because he was, yeah, that probably was exactly what I was doing.
Yeah. And then can you define or describe what protective factors are for people who may not know or listening?
Protective factors in this sense is the coping strategies that people develop to avoid feeling pain, to avoid feeling shame, to avoid being hurt. I mean, by our very nature, we're biologically hardwired to scan for threat all the time. So I think a lot of people end up coming to see people like you and me because it didn't work. It worked maybe at the time when they needed it, but unchecked, you know, still using those strategies where they're no longer necessary is causing more pain and more suffering and more hurt. But protective factors in a clinical sense is, do they have supports? Do they have family? What are their finances like? You know, what are their basic needs being met? So that's two prongs.
I have written that you would want to share a little bit about like your philosophy of counseling. I know we've already touched on a lot already, but that existential approach or thoughts around that. Do you have anything at all? Yeah.
For me, I really love the work of the existential philosophers and therapists that have gone on to teach students, so, and your humanists as well. So I really love working and diving deep into Carl Rogers, who was the father of person-centered, and Irvin Yalom, Spinelli, and a whole host of others that were the existentialists, because I think they're very closely linked to each other. And with the person-centered, as we've discussed, bringing that into an existential space, which is, to be human means we're going to experience anxiety. The degree of the anxiety is one thing, but we can't escape it. You know, I often joke with people who come to a session saying, I've got anxiety and I just can't cope. And I'll say to them, I can take you to a place where there no one has anxiety. Really? The cemetery. Because it's what it means to everything, you know, there's so many, it comes and it goes and it rises and it falls, and, you know, it becomes a problem when it's up here all the time. what I love about the existential is not only about the work that you're doing internally, but it's also how does being in the world affect the person? How does being in relationship with other people affect the person? How does being in relationship with themselves or their own self-awareness, how is that impacting on the person? But then the flip side is, how do they impact the world that they live in? How do they impact the relationships? And do you know what I mean? So it's a back and forth. And quite often the space that you're working with is, where's the boundary between what belongs with the self and what belongs with the other? A lot of the time it's relationships that is the number one reason why people come to see a therapist. And if I could use my own example before of the messiness of how I had just completely immersed myself into the other and forgotten who I was, the work for me was coming back to self, remembering who I was. It was almost like for a little bit of a time there, I knew who I was in my core, but I was becoming like a contortionist, trying to fit and mold into what the other's expectation was, which I think a lot of that work comes back to reconnecting with your values, because your values will inform your boundaries. And it's tough sometimes to say no. It's tough to let go of things that are no longer good for you. Well, now when you look at the relationship, is that a healthy relationship for you? Is that somewhere that now, as much as the attachment is strong to being in relationship with that person, is there things that, how are you affecting the other person too? And what are their boundaries, respect for their boundaries and respect for your own? Whatever is coming up in the clinical space, don't like to say clinical space, coming up in the session is to show it respect.
Relationship or desire for relationships are often what brings people into our spaces. So how does our relationship, how do you see that, like a counsellor, client or a participant relationship? How do you see that as a healing relationship in a way? How does that work?
I remember at uni again being asked the question, do you think religion has a space in counselling? And I thought about that. And for me, I think it is, because once upon a time, you have confession. People would go to confession. And now with therapy, you have a space where there are ethical boundaries. What is said in the space, unless they're of harm to themselves or to others or report harm to children or elderly, you're mandated to report. But other than that, anything, they're free to talk about whatever they want. Like, it's safe for them to say whatever they want. So it's a sacred space. Being able to trust another human being with the things that are being kept in the darkest, darkest places within them, and to let that out is a healing thing to do in connection, because we're hardwired to be in connection with others too. We're not meant to be in solitary.
I actually randomly ran into a woman on the beach yesterday, and she was sharing her journey with desiring to step into this space, but also desiring not to create dependency. And I was like, but relationships, or even if you're having a therapy client relationship, everyone's free to come and go. Choose if they would prefer that they do show the session, but choose if they do or don't. That's their choice. And sometimes there's dependency. But it doesn't mean you're like holding someone tight, like, dude, this is how you have to be in your life. It's like, yeah, okay, this is where we're at this moment in relationship and connection and sacred moment. Mm. I really love that description, and I think it's completely sacred. I can't see it in any other way. Mm. Because so this is, I'm just flowing now, but that for me, talking even about like the shame or the trauma or the things that come up, that's precious. Like, that's gold that maybe people wear as, like, as you were saying, calling it protective factors. But when they actually bring that up, that is a sacred alchemy that's taking place. And if that can be held, as you described earlier, with that anger, if it can be held and be like, you're okay, that's okay. I'm okay with that. That is so healing.
Mm-hmm.
Being witnessed or stuff, like being able to verbalize or say or do something and then someone to reflect, it's okay, I'm still here. Mm-hmm. It's like something inside of us changes when that's possible to process in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's through relationship. And one of the Sartre, I think it was, an existential philosopher, wrote about we get a sense of who we are based on what's reflected back to us. Mm-hmm. So I'm always very mindful of that as well. And for a lot of people, we've heard that term, you can't fix a problem with the same head that created it. And so the same thought process that created it. And so I think that's where your body work is really, really important to help shift those things so that it shifts things up in the cognitions to have a look at things from a different point of view. And this is just my own, it's not anything I've researched, but for me in being in relation in this way, I feel like it's not necessarily so much anything that I've said in the session, it's how they've felt in the session that lasts with them long after. The things we talk about in a session, I'm very open and honest with them at the very beginning. Am I allowed to swear in this space? Because I will say to them, you can bullshit me, but don't bullshit yourself. It's an emotional investment to actually participate in therapy because it's not what necessarily is done in therapy. It's what they take away and do between then.
I've said that before too, like, you can do that, but it's your time. you can tell me that. And that's how you want to use your session that way.
what's the point, you know? Then sometimes there are people that come and initially they just want to be heard. And that might look like they're a right fighter. You know, I need to be right. And tell me I'm right.
What would you share with people who are trying to learn how to really listen to someone, what their perspective is? So, yes, there's the reflection, but sometimes the same event could have happened to them and to me, and we would conceptualize it completely different. Mm-hmm. So how would you guide people who are listening to us maybe to, like, really listen to what that person is seeing, not how you're seeing?
First of all, I remember hearing, I think it was came out of the positive psychs movement, the closest any human being can be to another person's experience is through humour. I always hold that in the back of my mind that if you're having a laugh with a client, that's the closest connection you're ever going to have when it's a wholehearted, you know, laugh. But aside from that,
but I love that because I had one of those laughs a few days ago, just like cracking up over something ridiculous. And it was just like, and in our practice, we say, you know, healing's done. Like the bit, whatever you were working on is done when you start cracking up. Like, it's like when that crack up is like, suddenly you just see it for what it is. And you're like, can't stop laughing. You know, it's done.
Yeah.
That's what I was always taught. And I just love that as a reminder because sometimes people are like, can we be laughing about this? You know, and I'm like, yeah. It's funny. When someone's sharing something, how would you advise people, like energetically within themselves, to really listen to what that person, like how that person is conceptualizing it? Because I think that must be where we lose people too, is when we assume, oh, that happened, so that means that, rather than how are you seeing? How is this influencing you?
You hit it on the head. It's curiosity, being curious. And I think that's where the existential approach really interweaves with the person-centered approach because, I mean, if you were to practice person-centered and just that, it's the types of questions you ask are a bit different. But when you interweave that with an existential approach, it gives you permission to actually ask them, so what sense are you making of that? What story are you telling yourself about that? How has that impacted how you, like, what's the meaning you're attaching to this story? And then you get more.
I was just thinking about how sometimes when you really do that further digging, it's like it's surprising what you get like where those little, and that's sometimes people are surprised. They're like, that's the thing. that's the thing that I've been like circling on. It's like, when we can bring light into those things. And it's not always like bring up your trauma. It's like bring up your patterns sometimes. And once you realize that, you're like, oh, okay, so I can remove all these other thoughts in a way to work with how I nourish that bit.
For most of us, like I know myself, if I was to go and talk to my friends about something that was happening for me, they care about me. So they're going to say, oh, that person shouldn't have done that to you. That's really shitty and blah, blah, blah. Or you should do this or you should do that. But that's not what therapy is. It's not directive like that. So it helps people find their own way of being in the world and dealing with their problems through the resources that they have. It reminds me again of something that I keep thinking of Matt Kahn. He spoke about that when we're thinking, like we can overthink things. And really, when you think about who is thinking, is actually no thought at all, because it's all an automatic looping of the way that we do things. So having these kinds of conversations and asking these questions actually puts a little stop and an injunction in there to actually separate the thought from no thought.
I love Matt Kahn as well. I haven't listened to him for a really long time, but there's been certain things around that heart space that have really resonated with me and different points in my journey, especially maybe around two that it was at a certain point where I was probably like the lowest in my devotion to spirit, like that universe for me, and sort of listened to him a bit around that time. And I was like, oh, because I like the groundedness of how he talks as well. It's not just like in the air, there's an aspect of practicality within it too.
Yeah, it's funny how these things come to us when we need them the most, isn't it?
Can't help but combine my coaching training with counselling, even though it's a person's nature, but it is always a little bit of like some things that other people have come to try that on. How does that feel? They're stuck in that. So they might have like identified something similar to relationships, not know what a healthy relationship or not know how to love oneself. That's too much of a leap. Oh, suddenly self-love from never having self-love, or suddenly think different from, oh, you've identified the pain. But now in the offering, try ponder this, walk with this curiosity about what that might be in your life. Walk with that curiosity.
Yeah, I found that too. And I found he informed a lot of the way that I do my work. Him and Tara Brach.
I love her work as well. And I really like Tara Brach. What I admire about her is that she is so far along the journey and so well known, and she still has that humbleness to say, I was in this thing. I like that in the people I look to, is like a bit of humanness, like a bit of like, oh, I'm still navigating that. Like that's still something I went through, and that's what I hear with her, how she speaks. Really appreciate that.
And that's so important. I can't tell you the amount of times that a person has asked me about something that they're going through, and I don't know, but we'll work it out together. The not knowing, being able to sit in not knowing, is a really big thing.
Is there anything we've missed that you would want to voice for those listening, at all? Any wisdom you'd want to share?
I really know. I like the way that it was just emerging out of the discussion today, to be honest. I guess the biggest thing on my journey that is relevant, and from what I'm seeing in the field of therapy, whether it be psychologists or counselors or other healing spaces, is that you can only go with a person as far as you have been yourself. And that's been well documented in academia for a very long time, is that you can't take somebody beyond where you've been yourself. And so to do the work on yourself and heal those do your best to heal those broken bits. And if you're feeling triggered by any presentation, then for me, I look at triggers as those parts of us that still are popping their head up saying, hey, I'm still here. You haven't got rid of me yet. So it gives me another point of focus to, I need to do some more work on this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I'm so appreciative and grateful for everything you shared. And there's such yeah, such beauty in that.
Thank you for connecting with me for the first interview for Flourishing Practitioners. I look forward to sharing more of our archives with you and also connecting with new people along the way. If you want to find more out about my coaching or counselling work, just click on any of the links in the show notes or look me up. Thank you, dear heart. Aroha mai, aroha atu. Love given is love received.